Welcome to a new edition of the Famous Interviews with Joe Domino series. On this episode, we talk with actor, author, speaker, and international business advisor, Tyler Foley. He had a very galvanizing theater experience early on in life, and he got hooked on acting. He did have a medical incident that paralyzed the left side of his body for over a year at the age of 17. That changed him quite a bit. He has always been a highly motivated and successful professional that helps his clients share their message with confidence. For over 35 years, he has been an actor and performer. He is also a safety consultant, instructor, and keynote presenter. He also just happens to be the author of the number one best-selling book, The Power to Speak Naked. Tyler is full of stories and wisdom. Enjoy his insights and this interview.
Hi, Tyler. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing well.
Good, good. Hey, thanks for taking a minute out today.
Oh, no, it's my joy and my pleasure.
So, you know, before we get into, there's a myriad of things that you do, very talented at a lot of things. This last 2 years on planet Earth has been rather strange. There's been, you know, with COVID and everything that happened, how did you do over this time? What changed for you? What got better? How was it?
It was interesting because, you know, most of what I do is on stage speaking in front of people. So that obviously changed, but I got to be home a lot more, and especially with my daughter just in her formative years. She's 6 years old now. She'll be seven next month. So with her going into kindergarten and then grade one, I got to be home and, you know, be the one who is dropping her off at the bus and picking her up after school, and still was able to do a lot of the work. It just moved down into my studio in the basement as opposed to on the road. And it was really interesting because I did my first live presentation for the first time in about 2.5 years in May. I spoke at a safety conference up in Edmonton and then down at an event in Dallas towards the end of May. And it was interesting because it was a bit of a culture shock where I was away from the family for the first time in 2 years. And so it was definitely unique.
You know, there's a phenomenon. I've talked to musicians here in Kansas City that have said that the very first time that they got in front of a crowd, there were so many eyes looking at them, it freaked them out. Like, there's kind of this inverse phenomenon where people are getting back and things they used to be used to are kind of weird. It's almost like a psychological kind of quagmire that they walk into. So what was your feeling being in front of a lot of people again? Was it just natural?
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing this since I was 6 years old, so crowds is where I feel at home and safe. Stage is where I feel at home and safe. So it was actually a comforting thing. What was, again, the bit that felt weird was being away from the family, because I barely leave the house now. So the absence of my wife and my daughter was what felt off. Being in front of people was a natural transition back in. It didn't even register, to be honest.
So isn't it interesting, though? I mean, that's what I hear over and over, is that everybody got to get connected with their family through cooking and through all these other things. It's almost as though the universe whispered very loudly to all of us that we needed to do something different.
So I agree. It's something that I've been teaching in all of my seminars and courses, too. You know, the power of connection, the power of story, and really one of the big things that I feel is broken in the world is the isolation of everybody, which I thought was ironic that everybody isolating brought them closer together. You know, communities where you don't know your neighbors kind of thing. Like, me and my wife made a concentrated effort when we moved back into this house, because I've owned it since 2007, but we only moved back into the neighborhood 2 years ago. We made a concentrated effort to go around to every person on our street, and we, you know, knocked and said, this is who we are, this is our daughter, what do you do, what do we do? And we had a conversation 5 minutes or so at everybody's door in the neighborhood just to get to know the neighbors.
So where exactly are you located?
I'm in Calgary, Alberta, Canada.
You know, the one thing I got to tell you, you know, and I've increasingly noticed this over the last 6 months or so, I interview a lot of Canadian musicians, and a lot of musicians get grants to make albums. And I always love the whole idea that there's free healthcare. And then recently, Trudeau has made a commitment to really make some gun legislation that America doesn't have the backbone to do. And mm-hmm. I increasingly find the Canadian population and mentality to be so forthright and so good. I mean, the government genuinely holds medical care and the arts to a very high degree, and they don't just say it, they do it. And I from being on this side of the line, I am astounded that we just don't do that here. People go bankrupt. It's a big deal for medical insurance. I mean, a lot of musicians here, we have a fund called the CODA Jazz Fund, and that's just to get funds for a funeral because all of their medical expenses have been tapped out. So anyway, I have an increasing respect for the way the culture and mentality of the Canadian world works.
Well, and, you know, definitely the universal health care is helpful. I think it's a shame that people are going bankrupt or having to choose between you were just unbelievable choices, having to ration, you know, medications so they can afford food. Like, that to me is just such a bizarre and obscure concept, but it doesn't mean that we're not without our strife. Like, you know, I've been a performing actor and musician for 36 years, and I know that I regularly contribute to a charity that my union puts together, my acting union, called PAL, P-A-L, it's the Performing Arts Lodge, so that there is subsidized housing for actors and performers, because it's so often they can't, because of the gig nature of our employment, so many can't afford housing, and including me at one point. I remember I was 24 years old and I was homeless for almost a month. Now, it was only a month, and 2 weeks of that was because I was too stubborn to ask for help because I was prideful. But there was a point where it got to be too much, and I had to reach out for help from a friend, and more specifically, a friend's mom took me back in, and I, you know, she gave me my jump start and got me back on my feet and took me in for a couple of months for free, which was incredibly helpful. But ever since then, I've supported the Performing Arts Lodge, and PAL, because, you know, you can take the burden off of the healthcare system, but there's still other social pressures that need to be addressed and that we're not doing a good job of.
Yeah, and I guess there's no real utopia, but I think about those things that really affect the population here, especially healthcare, and it's just astonishing that we have to fight so hard to get some kind of equilibrium here. And speaking of medical, you know, you had an incident when you were 17 that probably shaped the rest of your life. So before we get to that, talk to me about your childhood. How did you get all of this motivation to be in front of people, to be an actor, and to do what you do?
Well, it started at six. It was the first time that I got to do a play. I was in a school play at Christmas, one of the, you know, elementary school pageants. I got to play Joseph in the school play, and, you know, that's the lead role, right? It's Joseph and Mary and the story of baby Jesus, and we got to recreate the nativity. And I remember getting a standing ovation. You know, it's parents, so of course you're going to do it. It had nothing to do with my performance, but I remember the sound, and I remember the feeling, and I remember the rush of it. It was very life-changing for me. It created the trajectory that I've been on, because most of my life has been centered around trying to recreate and re-feel that feeling. You know, I love the sound of applause. I love the validation that comes with a crowd that has been moved by what you have done, reward you back with their admiration. And I've loved that sound. I've chased it ever since. And then 2 months almost to the day after that first experience on stage, my father passed away. And it was, again, a very pivotal point in my life. I didn't actually outwardly grieve my father's passing for almost 6 years. You know, I was young. It's very hard to process the finality of death and what that actually means. And so I think out of concern, perhaps, or just needing something for me to do, because, you know, suddenly my mother was widowed and was left with two children to rear, very young. I was six. My sister was two. you know, needing just a break, both from time, because, you know, she worked late. And so if I had a thing to do late, that was one less thing that she had to worry about. And, you know, there was a financial bonus to it too, right? I got to earn money starting at 6 years old. And so I got to start in the theater and continue to pursue acting as a career at a very young age. And then that introduced me to some incredibly creative people, including musicians. You know, I started playing piano and keyboard at 10 years old. I started playing drums at 12, was in my first band at 15, had the joy and privilege to play with two Juno nominated bands. So that's the Canadian version of the Grammys. So I got to play with both Straight Clean and Simple, as well as Cranston Fields before they became Cranston Fusion, before they became Cranston Foundation, and then finally Coldest. That was, you know, really fun too. Like, I've always had my finger in my hand in the arts, and to be able to sit down and perform has been the thing that I've lived for the rest of my life. Even now in my career, you know, I retired from acting at 25 to pursue a quote unquote real job, get an engineering discipline under my belt, start my own company, which failed miserably. Even in all of that, performance was a part of it. You know, I led the sales team because I was the most comfortable talking to people, and I would give lunch and learn presentations. And again, that everything that I did had an element of presentation and an element of performance. And so everything that I've done, and now, you know, I have the luxury and joy of getting to coach people on how to be better public speakers, how to tell their story from stage. And a lot of what I do revolves around not being able to memorize words, but being able to tap into your own story to move an audience, to tell your story through a hero's journey story arc so that people can see your point of view.
So you had an incident when you were 17 where the left side of your body was paralyzed. Talk to me a little bit about that and how that changed the way you looked at the world.
Well, that's still a medical mystery too, but again, living in Canada, we got free healthcare, so I got to have all kinds of tests and things done to me just to try and figure out what it was. And what I do know is that New Year's Eve, 1996, I was a fully functional teenager, and New Year's Day, 1997, I woke up and the left side of my body didn't work. Yeah, I was going to a fine arts high school at the time. A part of the requirement to graduate from the fine arts school was to do the Performing Arts 35, which is the final play, and that was usually cast late September, early October. The play would go up for performance in April, and we would rehearse regularly for those 4 to 5 months. If you didn't do the performance, you didn't get the credits for that, and it was a requirement to graduate. So not only did that stop me from graduating from my school, I was able to get my GED because I had enough credits to graduate from high school as a, you know, a senior in high school and be able to get a diploma. I can't say that I'm a graduate of the Alberta High School of Fine Arts. I can say I attended the Alberta High School of Fine Arts, but it happened, you know, right just 4 or 5 months before graduation. It took me over a year to fully recover from it. But what it did do was remind me how much I want to be on stage. Because at that point, you know, I'm 17 years old. I've been performing professionally for 11 years. I'd taken it for granted that first of all, that I had talent. Right? Because a lot of times I wouldn't even need to audition. I would just get roles because casting directors and directors trusted me. And I was performing in a very, very small pool because, you know, I'm doing regional theater in a small market, and there's not a lot of kids who perform. Now, I'm lucky in that, again, I'm in an area where the arts is actually really well supported, both federally, provincially and then municipally. And we have the Calgary Stampede, which is the quote-unquote greatest outdoor show on earth, draws over 1 million people to the city over 10 days every summer. And they have a group of performers called the Young Canadians of the Calgary Stampede. And so it's an incredible training ground for youth talent. So it's not like I was uncommon and didn't have any competition. It's just I've been doing it so long that I had the bigger resume and I was kind of the known quantity and known entity. And so it was really easy for me to get jobs. And so when I was a senior in high school, I'd become very complacent with the craft. I didn't really take it seriously. I'd barely learn lines. I certainly wouldn't study a role or try to put any effort into it, because I really did think I was this natural talent with, you know, unbelievable skill. And so I literally just stopped trying. And then overnight it got taken away from me. And that was a definite wake-up call that anything can change in a blink of an eye. And that if I really wanted to do it, I needed to work harder and take it more seriously. And so not only did I dedicate almost an entire year to physical rehabilitation, but also strengthening my mental fortitude and changing my outlook on life and seeing things for the gifts that they are instead of taking them for granted, which you'd think at 6 years old, you know, having lost my father at six, that I would understand that things can change in the blink of an eye. But it wasn't really a lesson that set in until I was 17.
You know, I look at all of your acting credits, and I'm curious, out of all of those that you did throughout the years, what was one that really stood out to you? What was one of the favorite roles that you played?
So hands down, playing the teenage diner kid in Door to Door with William H. Macy and Dame Helen Mirren. That, to this day, is the highlight of my career. And there's lots on there that other people pick out. They're like, oh, you were in Freddy vs. Jason. I'm like, yeah, I was in Freddy vs. Jason. Again, because it's showy and flashy, and everybody knows Freddy Krueger. In fact, my character morphed into Freddy Krueger, so it's cool from a visual, but from a career satisfaction, getting to work with Bill and Helen, and it was I was only on set for one day, but I've never felt more like a movie star in my entire life than that experience. We were the only three characters with lines in that scene. They're obviously the stars of the show. I mean, it's William H. Macy and Dame Helen Mirren. Like, they were the stars of the show. In fact, Helen Mirren ended up winning a Golden Globe as Best Supporting Actress for her role in that movie. And there was one other performer that was being paid as an actor, and she played my girlfriend, but she didn't have any lines. And so because there was a small number of talent on set that day, very, very small set, I think there was like four or five extras in playing diner patrons. There was another couple of teams that were, quote unquote, our friends during the scene. And so I got to have this massive trailer. Like, normally as a day player, I'm put in the honey wagon, right? And you get this little... that, you know, prison cells are larger. You get these little 6x8 kind of rooms with a little bench that doubles as a change area. And, you know, you're lucky if you get your own toilet, because you're probably using the toilet at the end of the honey wagon. And there, you might have a little small table to sit at, you know, like they're just these little tiny rooms to hang in, if at all. So to have this massive fifth wheel trailer to myself was ridiculous. You know, it had like two couches, a full kitchenette, big bathroom, a separate bedroom that I could go in. And like, I didn't need it. And, you know, we filmed the scene overnight. William H. Macy at the time was learning to play guitar. And because of the role, he played a real life gentleman called Bill Porter, who was one of the top salesmen for the Watkins Company, and just an inspirational story unto itself. But to transform, to have William H. Macy transform into Bill Porter, he needed to undergo a lot of prosthetic makeup. And then on top of it, he plays Bill Porter from 1950 to 1990. So you have age makeup too. So in between, I got to be in the makeup trailer with him, getting my makeup done while he was undergoing the prosthetic change from an old Bill to a young Bill. And then we had a lot of time waiting on the setup because they'd done a full company move from what was, I think, it's supposed to be a 1980 setup to this diner, and it was a 1950 setup. So there's a lot of technical stuff that went on. So there was a lot of time in between filming. And he knocks on my door. He's like, "Hi, I'm Bill." I'm like, "I know who you are. I'm Tyler." He goes, "Hey, I'm bored sitting in my trailer alone. Do you mind if I come hang out with you?" I'm like, "No, man, come on in." He's like, "Do you mind if I bring in my guitar and play a little bit around?" I'm like, "Only if you don't mind me going over and grabbing my drum kit and we can play together." He's like, "You play?" I'm like, "I play, you play." He's like, "I play, let's play." And I remember him starting to pick out Hotel California. It was the first song that we played together. And me, you know, I did a really small setup. I just brought in three pieces. So I had the kick, the snare, and a floor tom. And I think I had my hi-hat, a ride, and like a single cymbal, you know, just kind of really small, almost a jazz kit set. And he starts strumming, and then I hit the kick. I'm like, "I'm jamming with William H. Macy." My star trailer on set. Like, I didn't think I could top that. And then, 5 months later, Dame Helen Mirren gets nominated for the Golden Globe. The scene that they played, and you know how they show like a clip from the movie on, you know, and Helen Mirren for Door to Door. The scene that they played was the scene with me, her, and Bill. So I got to have my mug blasted all over on live television from the Golden Globes. And like, I don't know how you live that down. To this day, it's my favorite experience being in the industry.
You know, I always get the feeling when I see William H. Macy that that's who he is. He's just a down-to-earth kind of guy.
He is the most humblest, most giving, most gracious talent I've ever worked with. The second only to Helen Mirren, who was incredible. But Helen was very reserved on set, I think. You know, she kind of kept to herself and did her thing. But when we were actually performing, man, did she give a lot. And was so gracious and, you know, worked with me and was asking me, you know, "How does this work? And if I do this, does that," like asking me, you know, I'm like, I think that feels right. Yeah. Like let's do this. Like she was just so good. But Bill was, he is the most down to earth, performer I've ever had the chance to work with. And I've worked with some really, really big names, and he was hands down the just genuinely coolest, most humble, giving. I can't say enough things about Bill.
In your daily life right now, every day you wake up, what do you look forward to? What is it that motivates you, that makes you do what you do?
Oh, that's a good question. Honestly, the things that I look forward to the most is sitting down with my wife at the end of the day, finding out how her day went, and finding out for my daughter how school was, and being able to be here for them. That is a big motivating factor for me. And to, you know, to be of service. Like my days are not, I don't have a standard day, right? I don't have a 9-to-5 where I start at this time, I end at this time, and I do these things. My days are always unique and different. You know, yesterday I was supposed to be doing a whole bunch of things, and then they got canceled last minute. So I found I had a day to myself. So I slept until noon and then went for a walk in our provincial park for almost 3 hours. and just kind of enjoyed nature and the sunshine and the day that we were having. And, you know, today I'm getting the luxury of getting to interview with you, and I'll be doing another podcast interview. I'm running a training session for one of my private masterminds in the afternoon. And I have a meeting with my accountant to do some filing. So, you know, my days are unique, but the thing that always motivates me is, you know, first of all, the family and making sure they're provided for, and then being of service. Like, I love when I get to run my mastermind. I love being able to serve people and, you know, see the growth in them from people who are terrified of the stage or want to be on stage but don't know how to start, and to be able to show them some guidance and show them that it's not really all that difficult to get on, and how they can have an impact. Like, I think that's the thing that motivates me the most in the work that I do, is I don't feel that I have a very big impact doing what I do. But where I do have impact is showing other people who have really incredible messages, really incredible stories, who can really, really change lives, find the arena to do that. And being able to see them then go out and do that and see an audience reaction and knowing that I had a part in helping them achieve that, that's where I get the most satisfaction.
So who would you consider a hero in your life?
Oh, so many. The first name that pops to mind would be Bob Corbett. He is a doctor of chiropractic and took me under his wing when I was younger. I'm best friends with his kids. The oldest friend that I have is his daughter, Vanda. We literally grew up together in utero. My mom was pregnant with me while her mom was pregnant with her. Her mom and her dad were my mom's chiropractors. And so while my mom was getting adjustments while she was pregnant, I'm obviously in the room there, and her mom was doing the adjustments and she was in the room there. And so we've literally known each other from the womb. And when I had my medical incident, it was Bob that really, you know, was the forefront of my medical care. Him and Joe did, his wife, were doing both chiropractic, and then Joe has so many letters after her name, so many incredible studies under her. So she was doing laser acupuncture for me. She was doing, herbal medicines, Chinese medicines. Then we were doing the chiropractic, and then they set me up with a really good physiotherapist, and they were kind of leading my medical team, because the doctors were like, well, we can't diagnose what you have, which I found frustrating at the time, but Bob really reframed it for me. He's like, the beautiful thing is not having a diagnosis, nothing is limiting your care, right? If they said you had a stroke, well, then this would be the course of action and you may never get your face back. But because we don't know, now there's the potential that you could. So look at instead of being frustrated because they don't know what's going on, be happy that you have the freedom to try anything to get better. And, you know, he's really instrumental in me getting involved in personal development and growth. He bought me my first ticket to my first seminar in my early 20s. I got to go to Dr. John DeMartini's Breakthrough Experience. Bob purchased that ticket as a gift. It's to this day the greatest gift I've ever received ever from anyone. And that really set me on a path to know that there was this whole other side, this whole industry that I could be a part of. I got to speak on stage May 20th on a stage that Tony Robbins headlined with Molly Bloom and Phil Town and some really amazing people in the industry. And I wouldn't have gotten to do that if it weren't for Bob's direction. You know, I even think a few years ago, I got a call to come speak on stage with Les Brown. And again, I wouldn't have had that opportunity if it weren't for Bob initially, like planting those seeds. So he's definitely a mentor and somebody I look up to, and somebody who, if I was trying to seek somebody's approval, because I don't, but there's something special when Bob's proud of me that, you know, kind of gives me that little extra jump in my step.
So let's say you have a dream tonight and you run into yourself when you're like 5 or 6 years old, and that child curiosity is there, and that child doesn't know that you are you as him as an adult. And he asks you, who are you? And you need to tell him who you are. After all these years and everything that you've done, how are you going to explain who you are to a younger version of you that's not aware it's you?
I don't know that I would bother. If he was to ask me who I am right now, I'd say I'm exactly who I need to be. I'm a father, a son, a husband, a performer, a seeker of warm beaches, and a lover of fine chocolates. And one day you can be all those things too.
What are you proudest of? You've accomplished a lot. You've done a lot of things. I don't know that the William H. Macy story can be topped, but you know, you've been down a lot of roads and done a lot of things. What are you proudest of when you really think back to what you've done?
That's easy. It's my daughter. You know, she's my greatest accomplishment. She is a mirror of all of my strengths and all of my weaknesses, because she's a direct reflection of who me and my wife are combined. It's always rewarding for me to hear other people say how incredible my daughter is. A lot of that has to do with her, but we have a part in making sure that those parts of her get to shine. And it's amazing how I can, you know, even how much she has tempered my temper, because I noticed early on how quickly she would get frustrated. And I didn't understand until I realized she was just patterning and mirroring my own behavior. Mm-hmm. And I was like, huh, amazing. And so then I had to change my behavior because it was a behavioral pattern that I wasn't aware of. But because, you know, children are so malleable in their growth at a young age that, they, you know, they're patterning the things that they see from their parents, and realizing that if I didn't do better, she was going to go down, you know, a very unrewarding path. And so to see the growth of my daughter, to hear the praise that she gets from teachers and peers and other parents and family is the greatest gift for to me. You know, like that, she's my greatest accomplishment, and will continue to be. I'm proud of her every day.
So when we get off the phone, a DeLorean pulls up in front of your house. You can climb in, punch in the digits, no strings attached, and you can go meet somebody, anybody in the history of humanity. Who are you going to go meet? Who has fascinated you that you would like to sit down and talk with?
So I don't need the DeLorean to do it. I just need to be able to get over to Seattle. I'd sit down with Dave Grohl. Yeah, I think he is. If I could put something on a bucket list, it would be to sit down with him, and not even to jam, because like there's no way that I could drum with Dave Grohl. Taylor Hawkins could barely drum with Dave Grohl, and Taylor was phenomenal. But I would definitely want to sit down with him just to, you know, because he's gone through some serious adversity and risen, and he's an unbelievably creative person. And at the same time, I get the impression, and I don't know because I've never met him, but that similar to William H. Macy, he is just grounded and down to earth and a real true human being. And, I would want to sit down and say hi to him. Second to that, I'd probably want to go back in time and be able to meet Neil Peart, because again, a drummer. And then if I could have a third place one, it would be Ryan Reynolds, because dude's just awesome and you know, a pillar of Canadian pride.
You know, have you seen Dave Grohl live?
I have. Yeah, I've seen and I've had the joy. I got to see Nirvana live. When I was very young, they were the first concert that I ever went to. And, I also have seen Foo Fighters 2 or 3 times. In fact, my cousin got asked up on stage to perform with Dave. You know, I would bring somebody up from the crowd, and he did, what did he do? Now I can't even remember what song he did, but Dave was bugging him, because he was like, you want to do that song? You know, you can't do that song. And he's like, no, I can do that song. And he nailed it, just nailed it. And, you know, that was pretty cool.
Yeah, and that's another thing about Dave that's so cool is that he does get people up there, and he's, I think that just shows his true colors. I saw him at a festival in Kansas City back in my 20s, and he was walking around the crowd just playing, and everybody's looking down and like, oh my God. And that was before everything really blew up for the Foo Fighters, but I remember that was a pretty cool moment. And I think since he's such a grounded cat, I wonder about him right now. And I know he's going to be a phoenix and he's going to rise out of this, but this whole thing with Taylor has just been, I just can't even imagine how that's playing on them. And, you know, how just, I mean, time will heal everything, but I've thought about him here and there, because their latest album's really good. One more question for you here, and it is, I want to make sure that everybody knows where they can go to learn more about you, speaking engagements, anything that you have out in the world creatively. How can folks find out what's going on with you and your world?
Well, the easiest thing that they can do is go to SeanTylerFoley.com, and Sean is spelled the proper Irish way, SeanTylerFoley.com. Just, you know, say Tyler sent you and we're happy to bring you in. And I'll tell you, Joe, if they're enjoying famous interviews with you, my gift to them would be, if they do come to SeanTylerFoley.com, right on the above the fold, first thing they have is a link to our Endless Stages Facebook group. And if they go through the website instead of just trying to come through Facebook, because you can, but if you go through the website, they get a whole bunch of freebies from us. So they get a PDF download of my number one best-selling book, The Power to Speak Naked. They get access to our Drop the Mic Trainer Program, which is a online course that's self-paced, self-directed. And then in Endless Stages itself, I go live every Tuesday at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, for 20 minutes and do a live training session with whoever happens to show up on the call that day. And so I would invite anybody in your audience to come do that, but only if they do me one favor, and that is to hit pause on whatever device they're listening to this now and give you a 5-star review and say what they enjoy about your show. Was it somebody that you had on? Is it your interview style? What makes them come back and listen to this time and time again? What makes them, you know, come 40 minutes later into this interview and still be listening? So if they can give you a 5-star review and make it a good one, because they're already on the device right now, so it's easy to do. You just hit pause, leave the review, now you come back. Then it would be my joy to have them visit SeanTylerFoley.com, and I'd be happy to give them all those freebies. But I would ask that they have some integrity and be honest about it and give you a 5-star review first.
Right on. Well, let me ask you one more thing. There is actually one more thing before we leave. I want to know, what has been one of the most memorable, captivating fan responses that you've gotten? You've delivered to thousands and thousands of people. You've been in front of many people throughout your life. What's been one of the best responses that just kind of threw you off guard or you always remember and go back to?
Well, the first one, right? At 6 years old, the first time I ever got a standing ovation, that one was very profound. And I've had a few since then that have just been where I've had to sit back and be like, this is surreal. How did we even get here? I remember getting to do a very, very large festival in my late teens with Cranston Fields. And my mom's boyfriend at the time was playing in a fairly well-known band. And there was a 3-day festival that came to our area, and he got to be on the stage on the first day and was able to, they had a main stage and a side stage, but the way that it was played in an outdoor field, and they had over 120,000 people attend. And so although everybody was facing the main stage, they just literally turned 90 degrees to then look at the side stage. And we got the opportunity, one of the bands dropped out last minute, and because my mom's boyfriend was there, he said, well, you know, my stepson plays in the band and they're really good. And they were like, well, excellent. Do you think they would come on? And we got a 15-minute set. That was all, because it was just in between stage setups on the main stage. And we got to play 5 songs. But to have 120,000 people
wow.
turn around to you and see us perform, even if only 5,000 were actually listening, it's still 5,000 people.
Wow.
And that one stands out. And then I was the valedictorian of my graduating class when I finished up at college. And it was a smaller crowd than that. I think there was only 6,000 people at the Jubilee Auditorium at the time, maybe 5,000 for the graduating ceremony. And I got to give my valedictorian speech. And then when I was done, they had given an honorary degree to, you know, a local businessman here who is very, very well respected within the community, net worth, you know, in the nine figures. And he turned to me and he's like, "Would you mind giving me a copy of your speech? I found that interesting." And I said, I asked what he wanted it for. He's like, "I'd like to, you know, to give this to my company." I'm like, "I'll do you one better. Bring me over and I'll come to your company. I'll give it as a keynote." And so to have made that connection and an inroad with him and get the endorsement from him and his company as a keynote presenter was also a source of pride for me to have put together a talk, you know, that was only 8 minutes long that had enough of an impact that a man who had grown a $1 billion empire wanted his employees and his company to hear my words was great.
So how long did it take to get that adrenaline rush of 120,000 people out of your system?
Oh, it still hasn't come out. I think about it and it still gives me a rush. That was cool. It's cool. It's a sea of humanity.
Oh man. I mean, you know, in my novice brain of just being a spectator, I've never been on a stage like that. I think about, you know, Queen and Wembley and huge crowds like that. And it's like, that's unbelievably intense. I mean, I even think about the shows that I see with Girl, because when he's up there and that band's going, that crowd is going crazy. So I just can't imagine the adrenaline rush they have to feel every single night going through all of that. You know, it's intense, you know.
Well, that would be one of my questions to Dave. Do you still feel it? I would like to think that you do. But is there a point where you become complacent to it or numb to it? And,
yeah.
And I would hope that the answer is no, but maybe it's yes. And I would love to know, if yes, at what point did it happen? And does it ever, you know, does it ebb and flow? I would love to know, because to me it's, you know, yeah, that crowd was just incredible.
So I did see, I think this was in that Kurt and Courtney film. There was a segment in there with Dave, and he was dealing with Kurt and everything that happened, and it was after he died. The band disbanded, and he was trying to figure out what he was going to do. This was before Foo Fighters. This was just him trying to find his way, and he was seriously at a point where he was like, "I don't think I'm going to be a musician anymore." And he went somewhere, and I think it was, he went to Africa. He went to a very remote place, and he's driving down a dirt road. There's no one around, and all of a sudden, there's a kid walking down the road. And he has a Nirvana shirt on.
Nirvana t-shirt, yeah.
Yeah. Do you remember that story? And
that
still freaks me out. It's like, talk about those moments in your life where you definitely feel as though there's a higher spiritual power and that you're not alone and that you feel some level of comfort. That story always stands out for me in the Dave Grohl catalog.
Oh, yeah. You know, and Tony Robbins says it best, life happens for us, not to us. And, you know, you look at what happened out of that as part of his cathartic release, you know, not wanting to be the drummer of Nirvana anymore. He sat down and cut a really raw emotional album that where he did every instrument, you know, he did guitars, drums, bass, vocals, and that became the first Foo Fighters album.
Yeah.
And you know, and think of the impact that I would say that Foo Fighters was a more impactful endeavor than Nirvana. And Nirvana is a game-changing band on the scene. Like, they are grunge. Without Nirvana, the grunge scene doesn't take off.
Yeah, they're definitely iconic, for sure. You know, Dave was doing that series where he was going to American cities, that HBO series where he was profiling different cities. Mm-hmm. And I had
and
heard
recording in different cities.
Yeah. And I remember seeing the New Orleans one, and as a jazz guy, you know, going to Preservation Hall and all of that. And I kind of heard a little bit that he might come to Kansas City, and I tried to reach out to see, which would have just been a total long shot. But I just thought, you know, if he got anywhere near Kansas City, it would be cool to just kind of arc into that world for like 60 seconds and say, hey, mm-hmm. what's up? What do you think? But yeah, I mean, he just seems like a really, the world's a better place with Dave Grohl in it, that's for sure.
Two-time Rock and Roll Hall of Famer for a reason.
Man, absolutely. Absolutely. Hey, man, Tyler, this has been wonderful, man. Thank you for opening up your world. Such wonderful stories. Thank you for being gracious enough to offer those out. I appreciate it.
Oh, Joe, it was my joy and my pleasure, so thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to another famous interview with Joe Domino, where we cover the world of art, literature, acting, and music around the globe. Most of the music on these episodes comes from Kevin MacLeod at Incompetech.com. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino in the iTunes Store. You can see these on the Neon Jazz channel at YouTube.com. And for everything Joe Domino related, go to JoeDomino.com. And when you're there, you can donate to us to keep this going via PayPal or Patreon. Until next time.